You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. Outdoor Edge knows that providing a freezer full of meat is part of the reason we all hunt. And what better way to bring it full circle than to process your own wild game? Outdoor Edge provides a full lineup of traditional and replaceable blade hunting knives and complete wild game processing kits to bring your wild game from the field to the freezer. Visit OutdoorEdge.com and at checkout, enter the discount code NATION30 for 30% off. HuntStand is the most popular and functional mobile hunting app on the market. With a variety of base maps to choose from, satellite imagery that is updated every month, the ability to check the weather, know property information, and even catalog your trail cam pics, HuntStand even gives you the ability to import pins and location markers from other mobile apps. Visit HuntStand.com or download wherever you download your apps. Enter discount code SN20 at checkout for 20% off.
Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. Guys, we really appreciate it. If you don't mind helping us out, we'd really like if you'd go and, you know, all the fun stuff wherever you download podcasts, if you can give us a review, give us five stars, do all that stuff. It's stuff that it's a little thing, but it goes a long way for our channel, and we would really, really appreciate that. It's been a blast doing this so far, and I can't wait for some of the upcoming episodes that we've got. And this week is no different. This week, Robbie and I had a chance to catch up with Dayton Hess and talk about his one heck of a 2021-22 hunting season, talking about his triple trophy that he harvested. And I was giving him a little bit of a hard time that he didn't do it all with the bow, but he got two of the three with his bow this year. And if any of you who have listened to this have ever been successful and got the triple trophy, you know it's quite a cool accomplishment to do here in Pennsylvania and fill all those tags out. And you know, it's kind of funny listening to Dayton talk about it. A lot of his conversation, he kind of kept saying, well, it just felt like luck. It just felt like luck. And yeah, you know, there's an element of luck for hunting. There's no doubt. There's an element of luck to a lot of things in life. But the thing that resonates with me the most is luck follows those who are well prepared. And I know from chatting with Dayton in the past and understanding what he does to prepare for his hunting season, he does a lot of homework. He does as much as he possibly can. And sometimes when the cards aren't in your favor in hunting season, sometimes you got to go with your guts. And, you know, you get a little bit of that story, but he definitely set himself up in the best situation he possibly could have, and he worked his tail off and got it done. And it's a really cool story. You're going to get a lot of detailed information about success in all three species, from the spring gobbler that he just harvested, back to the bear, back to the buck that he killed with his bow. And he's a very detail-oriented person. And I think there's something for anybody listening to this to take away. So looking forward to bringing you this episode. But before we start, I got to do some housekeeping stuff. I want to give a big shout out to Little Mountain Outfitters. Little Mountain Outfitters is an archery shop located in Richland, Pennsylvania. And if you are looking to upgrade your equipment or just get tuned up and get rock and rolling ready for the season, you should go and check them out. They've got all the big brand name bows that you would expect, plus more. From the archery accessories and gear side of things into the hunting side of things, we've got all kinds of different trades and tools and accessories, and you should really be sure to check them out. Something that will go a long way for you this fall. Unparalleled customer service, guys. Devon is an awesome bow tech, and it's definitely worth your time. So check them out, Little Mountain Outfitters. You can check them out on their website or on Facebook. So here we go with Dayton Hess. All right, we're live, and we got Dayton Hess on the phone, who is a stone-cold killer, and just this week finished up his triple trophy. So, Dayton, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Are you still on cloud nine at this point?
Yeah, I'm about as high as you can get on cloud nine.
So I remember talking to you earlier in the fall after you harvested your bear that you know this is what your third bear that you killed in Pennsylvania?
Fourth.
Your fourth one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, were you successful in getting a triple trophy the other times, or what was that like?
So this is my third one. One year I missed out on the buck. I just couldn't find the guy I was looking for, and thought I was going to make it happen late season that year, and it never happened. So I missed out on it.
But I see.
My third one. Yep.
I see. My first bear, I missed out on the buck. I got a bear and a gobbler, and didn't get the buck. But then the second one, I did get the triple trophy. So it's a pretty cool feat. It's you look back on it and it's kind of like, pinch me, I can't believe that just happened.
You're right. So a blessing every year, anytime you can make it happen, that's for sure.
So I guess before we dive into your fantastic hunting season, do me a favor and just introduce yourself. Tell me about yourself. You know, what do you do for a living? Tell me about what you're passionate about in hunting, so to speak. And, if you want to share where you're from, that kind of deal. But I'm looking forward to hearing all about your hunting prep and the success you had this year.
So I'm from Columbia County, 30 years old. I work for the state. I do some like construction management. I was born and raised on a farm, which is where I got most of my drive for hunting. You know, I've been blessed to be in an area in Columbia County that's full of wildlife, and just lucky enough to be born into a farm that has, you know, a lot of acres, and it's given me a lot of, you know, ability to be out in the outdoors all the time and chasing after the things that I enjoy most. And other than my family, hunting is my, you know, my thing, you know. So I do a lot of trapping as well. I just spend a lot of time in the outdoors. It's what I really enjoy.
You really do. I feel like every time that I get the chance to chat with you or chat with your dad or something, you're always doing something. And that's like, you know, our show's called The Pennsylvania Woodsman. And I feel like that's part of a true definition. Like, you are always out doing something. And that's, you know, that's fantastic. And I think that really tails into a lot of your success. So out of all the things you do, I mean, you pretty much will dabble in anything. I mean, I think if they had a season for shadows, you'd probably go after it. But what do you really gravitate towards the most?
If I could only pick one thing to hunt in the whole world, it'd be the white-tailed deer. I love deer. I love everything about them. And just trying to figure them out. That's my thing. You know, I love hunting everything else. I love turkey hunting, but you know, everything that I, you know, my favorite is definitely the white-tailed deer.
Yeah. And you've put some good ones on the wall the past few years. So I wouldn't mind, since you're a white-tail fanatic like Robbie and I wouldn't mind kind of working backwards and in the progression of how your season went. And kind of starting off with your spring gobbler that you just killed this week. So I'll do the spoiler alert for everybody that listens to this. But you actually killed your bear and your buck with your bow this year. And I was giving you a pretty hard time that you should take the bow for the gobbler. But I heard your turkey hunting season was a little bit more difficult than you're used to having. So by all means, how was your turkey season?
My turkey season, well, you know what, I'm going to be honest, I was nervous. There was no way after the first week that I was going to keep after it with a bow. I had went on a hunting trip for turkey in mid-April out to Nebraska and Wyoming. And when I left, we had more turkeys this winter in my area than we had in the past couple of years, which the numbers have been a little lower than normal. And then I thought when I left, they were spread out just like they used to be, you know, everything. They were like in all these little patches of woods. And I thought, for it's going to be a good season. And when I got home, you know, I had a couple days before the season started, and I'm like, boy, where'd they all go? And I know we got a big snowstorm here while I was gone, and I don't know if that had something to do with it, but it seemed like they grouped back up, and they were in these odd groups of, you know, like four Longbeards, three Jakes, two Hens type of group, you know, the couple that I had found. And on the first day, I had some almost encounters, you know, I had a lot of action on the first day, and I had some at 50 yards and a group of five Longbeards and two Jakes, and they were so close together, and at the distance, I was worried about, you know, your pattern's pretty big at that range, and I just thought, you know, I'm going to have a better opportunity, and it never came, and I thought, well, they're here, you know, and I'll get them the next day, and, you know, it didn't happen there in the first week. I called to, you know, the same group. I played the same group basically for most of the first week, and just on interest, you know, I tried the Jake decoy. You try all your tricks on the, you know, and watching them every day. And I was after him before work and everything. And it just, wasn't going well. And then got into the second week, and, you know, I started hunting some other properties that I was able to hunt, and it just, it wasn't, you know, even, you know, I watch him go to roost at, you know, 8 o'clock, and you get there the next morning and you hear him gobble, you're 70 yards away, and you call, he gobbled to you. And then when you hit the ground, go the other way, you know, just, you know, your normal turkey hunting mishaps that you have. And I'm thinking, boy, this is just not going to happen. And,
so at this point, you were on your birds. You were on birds the whole time throughout the season. Am I correct?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd go maybe a night or two where I wouldn't find, you know, I spend a lot of time at night looking because I've had my most success. I, you know, our farm is basically 97% open land and then a little bit of wood. So my success has basically been in my past, and that's how I hunt everything, is based on what I've had success in the past, is, you know, finding the night before and then hoping they land in the field and you can call them. And so I spend a lot of time doing circles around, you know, fields. And, you know, and I was finding them at night, you know, three times a week or four times a week, but, and setting up on them, I just couldn't make it happen, to be honest with you. Just, it wasn't, the typical reaction you'd have that I've had success with in the past when you find them. You know, normally you find a good group, I've had good success.
But was it like henned up kind of, like, not like turkeys being turkeys henned up, or was it something else?
Well, I'd say it was turkeys being henned up, and, you know, and sometimes a couple days I called in, you know, there'd be three hens and three Longbeards, and I'd call in two hens, and I just call it, you know, maybe I wasn't just hitting the right, the sweet spot.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Wasn't getting lucky, but, you know, a lot of, you know, the season that the one night there was four Longbeards by themselves. And I watched them at 8:15. I watched them go in the woods, and I knew where they'd be basically within 100 yards because of the time of night. And, those turkeys never gobbled on roost in the morning. You know, some of the things that normally happen weren't happening this year. It seemed like the first week was, I'd say, good. And then after that, it definitely slowed down hard. The gobbling wasn't as good. The finding the turkeys wasn't as good.
Did something kind of pick up this week then that let a little fire in, or did just all the stars align, or what changed that ultimately led you to knocking a bird down this week?
Oh, well, luck, honestly. just persistence and luck, to be honest, because, you know, that group of five Longbeards that I had seen on the first day, my neighbor and his girlfriend had killed two of them right off of roost, you know, in that first week. So it knocked it down to three. And I had seen them a time or two, not, you know, on a neighbor farm, or I'd see them at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we weren't able to hunt in the afternoons at that point. And just, they weren't consistent anymore. And just the morning that I found them, I had actually went and hunted with a buddy before work, and he had some birds roosted, and he could only hunt to like 6:15, and then didn't get on him.
And you were hunting roost birds at that point.
Yeah. He had roosted them, and we didn't even call to him. We were hoping that they'd fly down into this field, and they didn't. And when they didn't, he had to leave for work. So I went home. I had, you know, a little bit of time before I had to leave for work and made a loop, and those three birds were out in a field, and there was a hen down below. And I thought, well, if I get down below there, I might be able to get in between there and just see what happens. And I sat down for a little bit, and that hen literally walked right by me, right, you know, within 5 yards of me, and walked right behind me and down through the woods. And those longbeards followed her, and just, you know, everything worked out. It was just everything worked out at the right time. Just
did,
luck, you know.
Did you
just
call to her at all, Dayton?
I didn't call to her at all. I had seen her, you know, she had been in, I would say she had nested early. She was feeding in the same field. I mean, and it's just one of those things where you're hunting the same area every day. Like every day I'd come out a half an hour after, when I'd go to work, she'd be in the same field every day. There was never any other turkeys with her. She was nesting right there. It's a thick brush patch. And I just knew that that's where she was going to go, because I knew that was that hen. She wasn't there when I came through, and she was in that field, and those longbeards were there. I thought, well, they're going to go back there. And I sat up there. I thought, well, I was going to call, but I didn't have to, because she was walking right at me, you know. And I just let her do her thing, and I just sat there, and they worked by me, and she worked by me, and everything came together.
Good deal. So I learned this from you chatting with the one you shot last year. I think I talked with you about it, and you said the one you killed last year, I believe you shot opening day or the first week. But you had said, like, you didn't make a call to the one that you shot this year, and I don't believe you made a call to the one you shot last year. You kind of just had a pattern down and figured out how you wanted to hunt them. And I found that interesting, because everybody – correct me if I'm wrong, Dayton, if that information is inaccurate.
No, that is 100% true.
What I find so interesting is, you know, you listen to turkey hunting podcasts, you watch turkey hunting shows, you talk to any big guru turkey hunting cult individual, and, you know, a lot of the time it's the, you know, take the temperature of the bird, you got to call this way, you got to make this call, running gun this way. And it definitely seems like, from your perspective, you are way more patient than more turkey hunters that I get to interact with or have listened to. Can you shed light on that, and like what your perspective is, aggressive versus kind of just being patient in that respect?
So, you know, my big thing is, and it's funny you say that, because I went hunting with a friend out west here this year, and he's like, boy, we hunt so different. And, you know, he's super aggressive compared to me, you know. And so, like I said in the beginning, I don't have wood, right? So everything I hunt is field, and that's how I've always hunted. So I always know if I screw these birds up today, they're not coming back to the field tomorrow. Mm. So I guess that's where I've learned my don't mess this up kind of thing. Don't overcall. Don't, you know, I do a lot with decoys. If, you know, like last year, my big thing was I didn't call. I had my decoys out. You know, I knew those birds were going to come into that field because I watched them the night before. And once they see your decoys, you know, you're calling them, in my opinion, you're calling them to see something or not to see something. But once they make that, once I know a turkey has seen my decoys or seen what they're looking for, I let the decoys do what they're going to do. You know, they know there's a turkey there, and you call, to me, in my opinion, you calling isn't going to change once they make eye contact with those turkeys, decoys or whatever they may be. But so I've learned to be really patient, because I know that, like, if I mess this up today, they might not be back to this field tomorrow. And I've never had a great turkey. You know, I don't have that wood that's full of turkeys, you know, the turkeys that my dad plants soybeans, and the turkeys from the neighbors come over to eat the soybeans, you know? So that's how I've always hunted. So I'm more of a wait guy, you know, I wait it out, and I'm not super aggressive. I just let nature do its thing. Don't get me wrong. I've called sometimes and had turkeys run 400 yards out of the woods and come right to you into your decoys. And that's great, but more times than not, it's more just me being patient and and watch, you know, doing the research and watching them the night before type of thing.
Yeah, I kind of learned that the hard way, so to speak, a couple times. I've been fortunate. I've been able to go down to Virginia the past few years. I wasn't able to go to this year. But the farm that I'm able to hunt in Virginia is open cattle pasture, and pretty much all the surrounding woods is on neighboring properties. There's a couple of isolated large oak trees and some large cedar trees in the center, but most of the roosting happens on one ridge that's wooded on the property, and then it happens off of the property. And the place is loaded with turkeys, but I've really just learned we kill more turkeys when we get in before light and we're positioned in a location that at some point in the day is going to filter birds through. Now, we've been fortunate. We've killed some birds off the roost with that setup, and we've also been fortunate that just sitting and being patient that we've been able to, and that's bit me in the past, because sometimes you're like, they're just over that ridge. Let's go move on them. In that open country, it's so easy to bust them because they got eyesight like you can't believe. So, you know, and I grew up kind of similar to your approach, is being patient. And there's sometimes I actually wonder when I'm hunting in the woods if I could get away with more than I do and if I should move. And I think it's just all styles of turkey hunting, but I really like that approach because I think that patience is going to pay off in a lot of times, especially when you can ride the season out like that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Before we get into the next thing, I was curious, you were talking about decoy spreads. Would you mind talking about your philosophy or approach on decoys if you have one? I mean, is it as simple as I get good decoys and put them out in front of me and hope it works? Or have you learned, you know, doing it as long as you have that way, have you learned certain things that tend to work a little bit more often in the approach of decoys?
So 95% of the time, I use Avian X decoys. The lifelike, you know, expensive decoys. And I found that I really think that it, you know, spending that extra money is worth it.
Okay.
You know? I mean, I've had, you know, just watching turkeys react to them for the last 5 or 6 years of using them compared to the little foam, you know, $15 ones. Yeah, that's what I use. But 95% of the time, I use a single hen setup. The only time that I don't is when the night before, if there's a couple long beards together, sometimes I have a Jake decoy, a Avian X Jake decoy that I'll put out just for like that territorial, you know, come in to kick that guy's butt type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But 95% of the time I just do a single hen. It seemed to work. That seems to work. If nothing else, that's like my go-to and seems to be worked the best for me. I've tried a lot of things. I've tried more than one, you know, I've tried more than one hand, and, you know, I've tried all sorts of different things, but the single hand just, you know, it seems to work best for me. I don't know. I know a lot of guys have a lot of different opinions, but that's for my area. That seems what I've been successful with.
What do you think, Robbie?
That's with the single hand. That's exactly what my dad uses. I think he has one of the cheaper ones, but that's all he ever uses is that single hen. And just to backtrack real quick, when we were talking about patience, that's basically all Dale talked about when we had a podcast with
Dale.
Is he just said, I think his exact term was turkeys are going to turkey. And once they, like you said, lock eyes with that decoy, or once they hear you, they know where you're at and they're going to do what they want to do. So that patience is key.
Yeah, for sure. That's cool. I appreciate you sharing that with us. So continuing on with the theme of the Triple Trophy, if we rewind back, next on your list that you harvested was one heck of a black bear.
Yeah, he was a pretty nice bear. Beautiful. Had a white butterfly on his chest. It
really?
Was really cool.
That's awesome.
Yep. It was nice. Really neat.
That was a male, correct?
Yep, it was a boar, 250 pounds.
Nice. That was field dressed.
Yep, field dressed.
That's a heck of a bear. And you, the next thing that's kicking me, I'm a whitetail guy too, but I have it recently under my skin that I want to kill one with the bow. I want to kill a Pennsylvania bear with the bow in the worst way. And like when I heard you killed one, I was ecstatic for you. But I was kind of like, okay, that's like just another leather notch in. I want to make it happen. So, were you, when you go into a hunting season every year, do you get into a mode where you get to, you start thinking bear hunting and focus on bear, or is bear kind of an afterthought once you harvest a buck?
So, I've killed a couple bears. So I've been blessed to have areas where I've been able to hunt bear and be successful. So, when I go into the season in the fall, my real priority is buck, and then I'll super focus on bear if I kill a buck. But if I'm hunting buck, my priority is buck.
Right.
At this point, I know there's a lot of my friends who have killed a lot of nice buck and all they really want to kill is a bear because they've never killed a bear before. But for me, at this point where I'm at, my priority is buck. I do love to hunt bear, but, like I said, my priority is always buck.
Mm-hmm. So this is your fourth one you killed, and obviously you killed this one with the bow, and I want to touch on that here in just a bit. But the three before that, were those – do you typically hunt bear in bear season by yourself, or do you – have you been, with a group of guys, and, do you hunt, some private land tracks, some public land tracks? Like, what is bear season typically look like for you in the past, 15 years or whatever?
So I've killed three bears. My first three bears with a rifle, and they were all hunting a private piece of ground that's surrounded by game land, hunting with a group of about 10 guys. It was an invite type of thing, cabin that they have. They have 1,200 acres there. And, I shot my first bear when I was 16. I killed the next one when I was 18. I killed my next one when I was 21. So the big years of your life, I killed, young. I was in high school. It was the coolest, it was great, and it was, but it was, a bunch of older guys giving me the opportunity, like, this is a good spot. You go in this good spot. A lot of those guys, it's a good property for bear. People push them in off the game land, pull oak trees and mountain laurel, and they had it down to a science, like, this is a good spot, you stand here. And I killed my first bear. I killed all three bears within 50 yards of the same spot, three bears within 50 yards.
Wow.
Within a 5-year period. That's crazy. Like, that's the golden spot, and I was a young kid and they were giving me a lot of opportunity. And then when I was that 21 to 30, I hunted with the same group of guys in bear season, but I quit getting, after I was 20, I didn't stand a single drive.
Okay.
I killed my three bears and I was, I had my success, and I was, there was younger kids there now and trying to get them bears. And,
sure. Sounds like the story of us. I killed my first bear when I was 13 years old, and I've been a driver ever since. And I was just lucky enough that I killed one when I was waiting for another drive to get set up as a driver. I was just sitting in a hollow waiting. So I'm curious, kind of said you had some people, guide you and lead you along. I'm assuming, those three that you killed that were pretty close to each other, were they all on drives? Do you guys got to post around game lands and use hunting pressure to your advantage? Or?
No, so what that cabin does and those group of guys, they, you eat breakfast till 9 o'clock and you let all the public land hunters push the bears and the neighboring properties, push the bears into these couple thick areas. And you do three or four drives during the day, in these thick patches. And they've had success doing that for, 20 years, in the same, or even long, maybe 25 years. It's the same couple patches of laurel, on the same side banks and they, 9 till 3, and then they stop and then they go back and play cards, it's like, the Pennsylvania tradition kind of cabin type of thing. And they just have that magical spot that, there's a lot of bears there, a lot of oak trees, a lot of mountain laurel, and they just gravitate to that area. And I've been lucky enough that I got invited to go there as a kid. And
sure.
It's just a good spot.
Now, so you kind of described oak trees, mountain laurel. So I'm assuming it's more of rugged, rugged bear country and not like that bottom land, thick swamp land like in other parts of the state.
Yeah, this is straight up mountain, top of a mountain area where those bears have been. And like this year, that's not where I killed my bear this year, but I did kill my bear this year up at my cabin in Sullivan County. It's not this cabin. It's about probably the trail of life 10 miles away.
Okay.
On another, you know, another mountain over. But yeah, a mountain ground, basically.
One last question I had was, so that piece that you went with those group of guys and, you know, they kind of led you on and put you in some good spots. After, you know, you got a little bit older and a little bit wiser and you kind of saw how things were laying, is there anything that stands out to you that made that spot or that setup work so much better than so many other places and stories of people bear hunting? Was there anything that stands out that was just like an aha moment of that's why this is so successful?
So that place that I killed those three bears, there's a bear killed there every year. Every year that I've ever hunted there, there's been a bear or two killed in the same. Huh. It's a flat on top that's Mount Laurel and oak tree, and then this valley that goes straight down the mountain. So it comes off that flat and it just rolls. It's just a giant bowl, and that bowl turns into a valley and it goes down the mountain. So, you know, it's like that. You're pushing the bears to that bowl. And then when they hit that bowl, they want to go down.
Okay.
Get away, you know, and it's out of the thick stuff. So you're just right at the bottom of that patch of, you know, 100 acres of mountain laurel, and they want to get out of that bottom and get down that mountain. And it's just one of those pinch points that, you know, they've killed a lot of bucks there. I don't hunt bucks there, but they've killed, you know, you stand there to hunt bears, but you see bucks and you know, animals go by. It's just one of those natural funnels, and it's just, you know, one of those God-given perfect spots to ambush an animal, and that's
kind of
it.
A natural, I mean, natural terrain feature that really aids well. Can you tell me, like, it sounds like it's a little bit of a slope. Is the slope more of a shaded side hill? Is it more of a sunny side hill? Is there anything different from hill to hill that maybe would, you know, gravitate bear there?
It's the top. It is a top and it's flat, and that flat just turns into this, this bowl, you know, I would say it's the valley itself is a north-south facing valley, shaded in the morning and in the afternoon, in the valley itself. It's flat. It's not like a side bank. It's just like that very tippy top of the mountain. It is the highest point and it's flat, you know, it's just hard to explain, I guess.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that gets tricky to explain stuff like that. I know. I wonder, maybe you've done this, maybe you haven't. I'm wondering, just thinking out loud, like when it comes to the realm of e-scouting and using, you know, some type of mapping service with Topo, is that something, do you think would show up on a Topo map, like if you were doing e-scouting in an area, that would say, hey, maybe I should check this pinch point out, or is it something that it's kind of subtle and you see it when you get there?
No, I mean, if I was hunting white-tailed buck, I would look, if I was looking at a map up there and that was the property I had to hunt, it'd be one of those spots that you're like, I need to get a tree stand in there. I bet you there's, you know, this thick, nasty brush and this draw coming up and this flat, full oak tree. It's like, it's just one of those spots that if you looked at it on a map, you would gravitate towards it, you know, if you were looking at Onyx or whatever map service you're using, you would know that spot, you know, and the old guys found that spot before there was Onyx and all this thing, you know, it's just, you would find it naturally or through a mapping app, you know, it's just one of those spots that it's like, you know, when you get there, you're like, oh, I'm in a good spot, you know, like this animal should go through here.
Yeah. Yeah. I get what you're saying. That's pretty cool. So enough of that. I just had to pick your brain on like what made that so good. But I want to hear all about the one with the bow because that's extremely exciting. So tell me about what transpired leading to you killing one a dandy of a bear with your bow.
What actually happened was whitetail buck. You know, I was after whitetail buck, you know. So our farm has always had some quality bucks, you know, since I was in high school. You know, we've had some 4 or 5 year old bucks that have been running around, and it seemed like up until 2020, you know, we would have quality bucks. It just, the quality has consistently went down from year to year in the last 5 or 6 years. And I really never, I have a cabin in Sullivan County that I never really, I trapped there a lot my whole life. I've trapped there, but I've never really hunted bucks because I've really, other than a couple times, you know, like driving to people and stuff in buck season, but not seriously hunted. Normally I hunt just on the farm. And in 2020, I started hanging some trail cameras at the cabin because, you know, we have some, I do the food plots. My dad's a farmer, so I'm in charge of the food plots because my dad doesn't have time to do it. So, so I do a lot of them. So I hung some cameras out in 2020, and I was after finding some different bucks, that some bigger bucks, hopefully, that I wasn't having on my farm that year. And I continued that into 2021. I actually harvested a buck up there in 2020.
Okay.
And I kept that going in 2021. And I don't know about where you were, but in 2021, last year, there was like, an amazing, nut crop, you know, all over. And
you're talking like, all nuts, like acorns, beech nuts. The places that I hunted, I saw very spotty acorns depending on where you were. However, some of the places I hunt, like Combing County, it was one of the best beech nuts crops I can ever remember in my lifetime.
Well, and that's exactly, we have no, where in my cabin in Sullivan County, we have absolutely no oak trees, and it is 50% beech trees. And, we had a beech nut crop like I've never even known that was possible. And, typically the bears that are there, full of huckleberry brush and huckleberry swamps, and they're there all, I mean, you see tons of bear when you're up there in the summer, you know, July, August, September, because there's tons of blue, like natural blueberries, huckleberries.
Right.
And as soon as that leaves, which is usually in end of September, the bears leave and they move to the next mountain chain over, which is where I was talking, where I normally hunt, full of oaks. They move from the, it seems like food wise, they move from the blueberries to the acorns. Well, this year, I was after a buck that was up there. There was a really nice buck. I couldn't keep my cameras on tree because the bears were ripping them off nonstop. And, they were just everywhere. I mean, it's just like they were not leaving. They were not leaving this year like they normally do. And my food plots were not getting hit like they normally do. And the bucks that I was after weren't showing up because there was, you know, our food plots consisted of clover and soybeans and ration, and those bears were in there foraging all the time.
Wow.
It was just, you know, I was at one day I had 9 bears on between 6 cameras. I had 9
Holy
different
cow.
Bears that I can identify, you know? So they were,
you got me frothing at the mouth here.
Yeah. So, but you know, at that time I was like, the buck that I was after, I'm like, these bears will not let these deer in these fields. It was killing me. And I hunted up there for buck the first week, one day the first week, and I had a bear come right to the bottom of my tree. Like one of those nervous encounters, like mm-hmm. this thing going to climb this tree, you know? And I ended up harvesting a buck at home that I was, the one that I was after here. And, I thought, well, when bear season comes back up, I'm going to try to kill him with my bow up there. And, so bear season came in on a Saturday and it rained, and I went up to where I had the most pictures. It was a food plot, like I said, clover, long, big food plot, couple hundred yards long, but real skinny. Call it like a pipeline type of food plot. And, didn't see anything that day. I thought, well, I got done with work a little early. I thought, I'm going to go up, you know, and just sit. You know, I have some deer standing. I'm just going to sit on the food plot, even if it's for an hour. You know, it's not like deer hunting. If I spooked there, I didn't really care because I was already done. I harvested my buck and I got up there. I was sat for 10 minutes and, this bear came out into the food plot, you know, 300 yards away. And I'm like, holy smokes. I can't believe, you know, when you go hunting bear, you really don't ever think that you're actually going to see a bear. And it was just like, whoa. And I'm like, and the whole time I'm like, well, it's 300 yards away and an hour before dark, you know, it's like, it's got a long way to go. And I wasn't getting overly excited because I know how many variables and that bear fed just like a deer would across a field. And he just, you know, a couple steps and eat, a couple steps and eat, a couple steps and eat. And, he worked his way. And I'm like, when he got to 100 yards, which he was literally sitting under the stand I was going to go to. And I'm like, nah, I'm not going to walk down there. I don't, you know, I think.
Yeah,
you know,
did you choose the blind because of the wind variable? Was the wind iffy that night? Or was it just the sheer fact that it was like, well, the wind's good regardless, but it's a little more comfortable here?
No, both. So the wind wasn't great the bears were coming from all over, you know, like they weren't like a deer where they're coming out on the same side of the field and they were working the way they were just like everywhere. And it's like, I didn't really feel like one spot was better than the other. And the blind that was there was super easy access. Like I was coming in late and I didn't want to walk across the food plot. I'm like, I'm sitting blind, you know, it's dead center in the middle of the food plot. It's not any better than one side than the other. I can shut the windows if the wind's bad. You know, it was just like, it seemed like a more simple option. Mm-hmm. Like, cause it's just like bear don't pattern like deer. Like you can pattern a buck, you know, and bears just do whatever they want, whenever they want. And it's like, I don't know. And like I said, I didn't really think I was going to kill a bear. I was just like, you know, I was going up for an hour. I was going to enjoy the afternoon. I was already done buck hunting, so the pressure was off. But I was just going to kind of just chill, have a good, you know, sit on my food plot that I planted type of thing. And like I said, he just fed like a deer across that field. And, and you know, he's sitting under that stand. He literally laid down eating, like raking in, you know, rats, like just stuff. And I'm like, man, I wish I was out there, you know. It would have been like a 20-yard chip shot, and he sat there for like 15 minutes. I'm like, it's getting darker and darker. I'm like, he's never going to get here before dark. And I was thinking that, and he stood up, and he just started walking, and he didn't feed until he got to 50 yards from that line. And I'm like, holy crap. He's like, I'm ranging, and he's like 48, 46, 44, and I'm like, oh, and then he started working away from me. I'm like, oh, no. I don't want, you know, like I shoot, you know, 70 yards in my yard, but I only really like to shoot my bow to 40 yards. Like sure. That's where I really feel comfortable. And, I'm like, man, I don't know. And then all of a sudden he kind of started quartering toward me and I ranged him. He was at 42 yards. And I'm like, boy, he was feeding and he was, you know, just perfectly broadside. And I'm like, I drew back and I'd never even sat in this blind. I usually hunt out of hang on stands. Mm-hmm. I've never hunted out of this blind ever. It was like a weird instance where I had never been in there. I have hang on stands all over up there. And I thought, well, so when I drew back, I wanted to make sure that I could actually, you know, it's big windows, but I drew back to test it, you know, cause he was, you know, it's getting dark and I'm like, I gotta make sure that everything's good. And I drew back and I was looking, I'm like, well, everything seems good. I'm already back there. He's broadside and I let the arrow fly and it was just like, it seemed like I haven't shot 40 yards in so long. It just seemed like forever for the arrow to hit him.
Yeah.
Cause it was like, I shot and like that, I'm like, what happened? And then whack, I heard it whack, you know, and that bear just turned and bit his shoulder and spun around and he just instantly went to the ground and rolled and rolled and rolled. And he went like 10 yards and he sat up and then sat back down. And then he did this only thing that called is that death moan, mm-hmm. you know? And I'm like, did that really just happen? You know, it was like, didn't even seem real. And then I was like, I sat there, you know, that was maybe like 20 minutes till dark. and you know, and there was oats and stuff in this field, and I could see him there, and I'm like, I just didn't want to get out until it was like, I knew, I gave him like a full half hour, you know, and I got out, and I didn't even go up to him. I left the food plot and called my dad because I was like, I was so excited. But part of me was like, I don't even want to walk up on him, you know, by myself, because I just didn't believe that it actually happened, you know. It was just such a good experience and just luck, you know. It was another, you know, just one of those, you know, just being out there, just being lucky type of thing. So I didn't do anything special. I knew there were bears hitting that food plot a lot, and I just went to sit for an afternoon, you know.
Well, one thing I will say, and I'll credit you for this, and I take the one big thing I take away from this conversation, I think back to the episode we did with Mark Lesher in the fall, talking specifically about bear hunting, and you know, Mark's a fantastic bear hunter, and one of the things he really drove home for me is, like, you know, if you find the food, you find the bears, which makes sense. But he's not afraid to drive miles and miles away from their typical old stomping ground, so to speak, to get to where they want to go and hunt. They will go wherever they got to go where there's food. And then you mentioned that where your camp is, it's all beech nuts, and usually the bear leave. And they go a few mountains over to where you hunt them, where there's a mass crop. And I think that's a big thing to take away from for anybody, is you've got food, follow the food. And I mean, it's, and I have to agree with you. Like, it doesn't seem like you can really pattern the things. It's like, if you're in the area with the food and the cover and all the things you need, then it's just a matter of putting your time in and being a hunter and doing it. But you know, you obviously did your homework in a sense, because you knew there was food holding them.
Right.
That's right. Really,
and
cool.
And you know, those bears hung out there the whole season. I mean, there were still bears there this winter. Like, I was up there trapping, and I would cut, you know, young boar tracks. They're still out digging beech nuts, and they're never there that time of year. I mean, it was one of those years that, and they stuck there the whole year. I mean, and they're there this spring. Like, the bears stayed there because there's still beech nuts on the ground. And
wow.
It's amazing how those beech nuts held them bears. I mean, it's truly amazing, because there's never – I mean, this was a – there's always a couple bears there because it's the mountain, but not anything like this year. It was 100% food-driven. I've never seen anything like it. It was just – and the same thing for the deer. They stayed out of the food plot a lot more than they normally do, because there was so much – the beech nuts food. You got straight there. It's just food, you know. Mm-hmm.
Good deal. Well, hey, let's shift gears one more time, and let's get into the bread and butter of your hunting season, I guess, for you, and that's always whitetails, as we discussed earlier. But once again, you found a way to get it done. But I remember talking with you toward the beginning of the season or mid season, and it sounded like you were a little bit more skeptical this year. I mean, you even said earlier that, you know, up until like 2020, it seems like it's just been a little bit different than it was years ago, where you're used to hunting. But you were still able to get it done on a dandy. So I'd take the floor with it. I mean, tell me, I know a few years ago you killed an absolute dandy at your farm there, and there was kind of a neat history with that deer. So, I mean, tell me a little bit about your hunting strategy around your place, and, you know, what was different this year, and how did you adjust to get it done?
So my big, I spend the deer, you know, I always, like I said in the beginning, our farm is fields. All the deer live on the neighbors. You know, the deer that come to our property are the neighbor's deer. You know, I call them my deer all the time. That's my buck, you know, my deer, but they're really the neighbor. They live in the neighbor's woods, you know, and they come out to feed. And, you know, a thing that, you know, I run a ton of cameras. I have a ton of cameras, and, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at trail cam pictures, but my big thing is me and my wife and now my daughter, we enjoy, you know, that going around, riding around the farm at night and looking for deer. You know, it's just like something that we enjoy to do together. And I've enjoyed it, you know, since I was, you know, able to drive. That's how I, everything I do is almost a nightly loop. I have the same loop. I look for the same deer, you know. So my strategy basically is food, you know, for everything. In my opinion, you know, no amount of cover or woods is going to beat food. And I say that because, you know, even in the rut, the doe eat, you know, right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
you spend enough time on the field edge, you're going to, if you have good bucks, you're going to have an opportunity, even in the rut, you know? So that's my strategy, is because that's what I have, you know, is hunts field edges, hedgerows, field edges. And now, like I said, I've spent a little time here in the last couple of years hunting, you know, in Sullivan County at my cabin, and it's big woods. But you know, when I go up there, you can't take me out of the same thing that I've always known, is I hunt on the edge of the food plot. I can't get in the woods. That's just, I'd love to, but I just, it's what I know. That's my strategy. And this year, you know, I had a 3-year-old buck last year. He was like maybe 110 inch. He was 19 inches wide, real short point. You know, me and the neighbor both, had talked about him. I had a ton of pictures of him in the winter. And like, you know, what's this buck going to be next year? You know, he was, you know, we didn't have many 3-year-old bucks that had made it through, you know, and coming into the season. We really had, since 2020, it really declined. We were having, our age class went down, I'd say like from four and five to 2 and 3. And, you know, and you were trying to find that 4-year-old type of buck instead of that, maybe that 5-year-old type of buck. And, we talked about this buck and, you know, he was back and forth from one property. He wasn't consistent on my farm all the time, but in the winter we have the food and he was there a lot and we talked about it. And actually my neighbor had found the sheds from him and he told me, hey, I found the sheds from this buck. And we called him the wide eight because he was a wide, you know, a wide young eight. And, moving into this season, he showed up, you know, that my neighbor's side of the farm, I see him out in the field, you know, in that August, September, and everyone would say, you see that buck like 2 feet wide on your hill, you know? And I'm like, yeah, I've seen him, but you know, he just,
yeah, you're not supposed to, but I've seen him.
Yeah. Yeah, right. You know, and he was right there all summer. And then, you know, that magical thing that happens to most hunters, they see him all summer.
Good old whitetail shift.
Yeah, the whitetail shift, right? And I knew it was going to happen because I didn't have, you know, I had him the summer before and I had him in that winter, but I didn't have him in the season. And that's exactly what happened. You know, velvet came off mid-September. I'd see him spotting deer at night every once in a while in fields, but he lost his consistency. Mm-hmm. And my focus kind of shifted. I knew like my best chance to kill him was now in the, you know, last week of October. Like I knew like after the first week, I didn't have a chance to kill this buck. Like I knew until the rut, he wasn't coming back. Most likely that was my thought. And I focused my shift onto another buck. I was going to hunt the couple first days at the farm. And then I had a nice buck at the cabin that was the same type of, you know, class of deer up there. I was going to hunt there when I had enough time to get up there after work. And, that's what I did. I hunted the first couple days here. He never showed up and there was no other buck at the farm that I was really interested in shooting that I felt like was there. I went up there and I hunted that buck. And like I said, I had a couple encounters with some bear and some small buck. And, the season kind of going into the second week and the deer just, they did that October thing that they do where they quit hitting the field. Mm-hmm. And my gut told me like, hey, I always thought everybody calls it the October lull, mm-hmm. you know, kicked in. I call it acorn season. That's what I call it.
Yeah.
So, they quit hitting the field and they go to, in my mind, they go to the next best thing, which is the acorns start dropping the trees. No sense leaving the woods when I can stay cool in the woods and eat acorns that are better anyway. So I have, a property that we lease, like a mile down the road, probably from, it's just a big piece of woods, nothing special. And it got logged a couple years ago been super tough to get in and out of because just the way they logged it, it's just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
The deer didn't do what they normally did in there anymore, and there's more pressure there than there used to be from the new. It wasn't what it used to be, and I thought, you know, I didn't have time to get to the cabin. You know, it's a 45-minute drive, and they're in the field, and I had a tree stand up in there, and I thought it was going to be I had a day off work coming for Columbus Day, and that was on Monday, and I thought, that Friday, I'm going to go up there after work. It's a morning spot. It's just not an afternoon spot. I've never really had success there in the afternoon. But I thought, I'm going to go up there. I'm going to take a ratchet strap with me after work. I'm going to check this tree stand. I didn't even go up there because I wasn't going to hunt there. I wasn't going to hunt there this year. I had a tree stand. I thought, I'll go take the seed up with me. I'll scout. See what's happening up there. It's right on the edge of this old cut. And I went up there, and it was 85 degrees. And I walked up a giant hill covered in sweat, and I was thinking, I would never see a deer in the moon. I stunk so bad. Like, I was covered in sweat. Put a new ratchet strap on. You know how it is when you're hanging off the tree, putting a ratchet strap. I sat down there and just kind of enjoying the night. And I took all my, you know, I down to it, just a long sleeve shirt, and thought, well, when it gets closer to dark, I'll start putting my clothes on. And I sat there for like 20 minutes, and just, again, another luck thing. This 16-inch eight pointer comes walking up the same trail that I walked in on, and I'll never forget it because there's poke berries. He's got logs, and there's this poke berry weed, you know, that have the purple berries.
Yep.
And this 16-inch buck had purple horns. Like, he had just rubbed this poke berry, and I was just like in awe looking at this purple horn buck, and I'm like, holy crap, that's my buck. Here comes my buck behind him, you know?
No way.
And, yeah. And you know, I was 100% that he was not living in this area. He was, I really thought he was two hillsides over is where his core area was. And it still might have been, I don't know. But I wasn't expecting to see this buck there. You know, I was hoping to find a buck that I'd never seen. It's far enough away, this woods, that it draws in a couple different farms on the other side. And it's one of those spots that you never know where you're going to get there. You can pull bucks from different areas, pull bucks from my own farm, but it's just a different spot to hunt. And there he was, and he walked into, like, you know, to make a long story short, it was like a standoff there for a little while, but he walked in like 25 yards, and I was able to get an arrow into him. He took off and only went about 100 yards and crashed. So it was awesome. Just like one of those gifts from God that you're just like, boy, that was not supposed to happen, but thank you.
I've been in those, but those are kind of extra sweet. So yeah. I'm curious, after you killed that deer, I'm sure, you know, there was some amazement and a little bit baffled by, you know, what transpired. Did you go back and kind of try to break that apart and try to figure out it, or try to put in a picture in your mind of why that happened the way it did? Is there anything that stood out and said, you know what, it makes sense now that this deer moved into this piece of woods that we lease, or anything like that that says, you know what, I get it?
Yes and no. So where I was seeing him was, that was the side of the farm he was on, was the side that he was like two valleys over on this giant ridge. And at the time, you know, I knew my neighbor. I guess most of my putting things together before the season was, my neighbor has him here. I know where my neighbor's property is, and he was sharing. We share pictures and we share information with each other. We're a good neighbor, you know, just like one of those neighbors.
Sure.
Like, he wants success for me, I want success for him, you know. And I knew that he was having him a lot more than me, right? So I thought his core area was more that way. But looking back, we were both on maybe the outer circle of it all. We might have been, you know, the outer circle of, well, this is because we were seeing, you know, and it makes sense now that I was seeing him spotting deer instead of out in the field at, you know, dusk. You know, he was there at
8 o'clock and 9 o'clock, not 6 o'clock. Mm. You know, it was taking him 3 hours. He was working. I think he had just a big core area. I think he was, and that's why in the winter he was there, you know, cause the food was there. But in the summer and the fall, he was in that giant, you know, that woods that I'm talking about hunting is, you know, it's only a 150 acre piece that I'm able to hunt, but that woods in general might be a 1,000 acre piece. With fields. It's too hollow. It's a big, for around where I live, it's a giant piece of woods. Mm. A lot of different people own that piece of woods. You know, it's not one landowner owns that 1,000 acres, but it's this giant hollow, and it's just, it's a good spot for deer to, yeah. So, you know, the whole time that my mind was thinking maybe that the core area was in a different spot, I think I was seeing him on the fringes eating his food, because where he was, you know, he was living in the woods and, not living in a small patch of woods like a lot of times that they do. He was coming a long way for food, because there's no other food. Like, that was his core area. He had to come, you know, a half mile every night for food. And I just, I'm not used to seeing that where I hunt. So, okay. You know, I think that putting it all together is maybe I take for granted that, you know, there's, you know, they don't always live in this little piece of woods and move from one neighbor to another. Sometimes they come a long way for food, and, you know, and that's where I'm hunting normally is food. And that's where I thought, you know, I guess it's different than normal.
Sure. Very cool. You know, you talked about food, and I can definitely echo what you're saying there. Being around a property where we've continued to just expand food plots and know the power of food plots, you know, I find it tricky to hunt them sometimes when you're hunting hill terrain. I do feel like when you have the capability of having a blind that's sealed in, I do feel a little bit more invincible, so to speak, when you have those swirling wind conditions that are inevitable in those in that type of terrain. But, you know, the food is definitely king. And one thing that I talk about on this channel a lot, and have talked about with other people, is I really like if it's a property that's set up for hunting and hunting alone, I really try to like to have consistency in the food sources. That way you can have a more predictable hunting season. You know, our food plot plan, so to speak, what we've been doing the past few years is every food plot, you know, it's in a location all the merits that you would normally do it. And every food plot has the same food plot in it. 50% of it is a brassica blend, and then the other 50% of it is clover, beans, peas, and we usually top dress everything with cereal rye. And the theory is that we've got food that should be sustainable season long, from the beginning of the season to the end of the season, and it's in the same location, so we can hopefully count on deer moving and relating to that food source and make a more predictable hunt. One of the challenges I know you face is the fact that hunting a farm while you have food, it's forever changing. The location and the crop rotation in your neck of the woods doesn't always stay consistent. I mean, you know, just to give an example, I mean, you might have an alfalfa field that stays in the same location 3, 4, 5 years. And, you know, then it rotates out, but, the corn, the soybeans, the, you know, everything that's going on a farm like that, it's ever changing. So with that in mind, how do you go about, zoning in? Do you tend to key on certain times of the season on your farm for those very reasons of food changing? Do you just gravitate to certain portions of the farm when it's in certain crops? You know, for instance, if you've got corn that's standing longer, you might have more security cover. You know, share a little bit about that with me, if you wouldn't mind.
So, the whole time you're talking, I'm here nodding my head, like, yeah, like, it's tough, you know. So, you know, alfalfa is awesome. Like the first couple weeks, you know, like I still kill a lot of doe on alfalfa fields. Like when I'm going to, you know, harvest a doe in bow season, I usually hit the alfalfa fields because
that's where the majority of the deer are in that first 2 weeks. I focus a lot on begging my dad, please don't harvest that cornfield, you know, in the end of the season, you know? So, you know, I guess a lot of guys really love, you know, we get people who call my dad, on land that he rents for farming. Hey, can you get this cornfield off for me? I want to bow hunt and I want the corn to be off. And that there is a magical 3 days, in my opinion, of that corn being off. The deer just feel
special.
I don't know if they feel like there's still corn there and they're protected and they come out early and there is that amazing 3 days. But, there's also, you know, I feel like if you have a 20 acre cornfield, you have like that food cover mix, you know, I've killed a lot of bucks in the rut, that seeking rut type, of rut in the beginning part of the rut on standing corn. I focus a lot of my time on the corners of standing cornfields, like those weak corners that farmers hate, you know, that the deer just, you know, you'll know when you walk around that field.
Sure.
And it's just like, this is the corner that the deer come in, right? And then that's, I focus a lot on those corners, of cornfield. You know, I don't, you know, that beginning, maybe week, maybe some soybean fields that are still green, but soybeans don't do much for me in bow season. From a farmer standpoint, cause my dad usually has, you know, they're normally brown and the deer aren't eating them, in bow season, but my dad does a lot of, cover crop on our farm and those fields that he gets in early from those early harvested beans with that new green growth. You know, cover crop, very similar to what you're talking about with the brassicas and the rye and all those special things, the sunflowers and the soybeans that are coming up that are, you know, that new growth 2 inches high. I hit them in the late parts of the season when they're bright green and everything else is not bright green. Even that alfalfa that's starting to die off. You know, I play the food. I play the food, sure. Whatever is, you know, same thing. I get done hunting. I go spotlighting. You know, I'm big on, I guess most of my hunting is scouting, you know, like when I'm done hunting, I go look. On Sundays, I go look, you know, I just, for where I hunt, I have to look a lot.
Yeah.
Patterns, yeah. Deer. Things are changing a lot, you know, food sources that time of year and everything.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. I've heard people talk about using spotlighting as a tool, and it seems so foreign to me. And the reason for that is because so much of the ground that I hunt is large monotonous timber, and while I can spot some crop fields that are within that deer's home range, the fields are that large and where the timber actually meets. You don't really get a great snapshot all the time. You might see some deer at certain times, but I don't feel like I get that MRI and that feedback on a regular basis like you would hope in that case. But I can obviously see how that would be a really important tool. Do you ever have to get creative, you know, knowing that the farm is mostly fields and there's not a lot of woods and cover, do you ever have to get creative in your ambush points based on those crop rotations?
Definitely. Like if you know some of my biggest bucks, if you saw where I killed them, you'd laugh at me. Like, you know, sometimes I have to get into a 12 inch maple tree in a hedgerow 12 feet off the ground because it's all I have to get into, because that's where they're coming. That's where they're coming for that food that night. And I don't have, I definitely have to get creative sometimes. I've had, ground blinds set up on the edge of my yard. You know, I've done all sorts of things because, you know, I don't have that woods and to be on that food and just the food, sometimes you have to do some creative things like getting small trees and, you know, all sorts of different things. But
have you had to kill some off the ground too?
I have never killed one off the ground. I've tried a lot of times. I just never had the success that I wanted out of ground blind. I've had better success for me being 10 feet off the ground in a 10 inch tree or a 12 inch tree than I have on the ground.
So does that mean go ahead.
I think part of it's just every time I've hunted out of a ground blind for where I am, just the wind is hunting on, you know, in hedgerows and stuff. It's tough with a ground blind, I think, for me where I'm at.
That makes
I know
sense.
A lot of guys have great success with it, but.
What do you think, Robbie? I lost my train of thought. You have anything for him?
Yeah, I don't really have a question. It's my two cents about it. I just think it's really interesting and cool, and it's just another instance of, and the bear that you killed in particular, it's just another way in Pennsylvania that you're able to harvest a bear. I mean, when we talked to Mark Lesher, when he does all of his drives, the standers are the ones that kill most of the bear. Up at my camp and all my drives, the drivers are the ones to kill most of the bear. I mean, you saw 9 bear on camera and were able to get one over a food plot this year. My brother saw one in archery season. He didn't take a shot at, came 6 yards in front of him. And I think it just shocked him first time he saw a bear in the woods. And, so he didn't get one, but he was just sitting in a tree stand.
I think he changed his pants when he was done.
Yeah,
that's what he did.
Yeah. And then that next, that same day in archery season, my cousin and I were just meandering through a chop, and he and I saw one. And if we had a rifle in hand, it would have been down, but with a bow, it was a little tough and a chop off. But just all the different ways you can, like you said, you can't really pattern them. The black bear, you can see them and try to go back to where you think they are, but they're just tough to kill. And
for sure,
like we talked about with the turkey, patience, patience, patience.
Yeah. I know one thing I wanted to ask you, Dayton. I just thought of it. So bouncing around on your home farm there, you talked about getting in a 12-inch maple and doing some crazy stuff. Does that mean that you are much more mobile in your setups, or do you kind of, you know, do your rounds and, you know, come up with your game plan, and then when you have a spell where you can get in, you'll hang up a hang on there and then keep it there for a little while and adjust that way?
So I have like probably a dozen or so, maybe 15 hang on stands on the farm, and relatively, like, I change the ratchet straps on them. Like, they're there every year. Like, they're the spots, you know? Like, I've moved them in the last 5 years, I haven't moved them because I've moved them so many times in my life. Like, I've hunted this farm my whole life. So, and I look at it every day and I go, so I know where those 15 or 12 hot spots are. But then I have my mobile stands, you know, my three hang ons every year that maybe move, you know? And like, you know, some of those biggest bucks that I've killed here are been the ones that were like, I asked my wife to come with me, you know, and stand on the edge of a field, but I put one up so in case I fall down, she can call 911, and I throw it up in a 15 minute in a little hedgerow, you know, let's just see if it keeps doing this, you know, and I like to be done putting my tree stands out a month before the season, just because I'm like super don't disturb, don't get my scent kind of guy.
Right.
I'm super big on not disturbing a pattern of any, like, I don't like to drive or walk or check, you know, that's why I love cell cams, because I just don't like screwing up a deer's, especially in that final month. I think it makes a big deal, but.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more there. It's definitely not going to hurt you in the long run if you take the cautious route, there's no doubt there. But good deal. Man, that was one heck of a season. That was an awesome synopsis of just reiterating your story and getting into the nitty-gritty and details of it. So I really, again, thank you for sharing that with all of us.
And congratulations.
For sure.
Yeah.
You have a hell of a taxidermy bill this year.
Yeah, I do.
Hell of a taxidermy bill and a patient wife.
yes, I do.
Good deal. Hey, is there anything else you'd like to share with us, or any parting words for us?
No, just good luck to everybody on their rest of their turkey hunt and going into the next year, I guess.
Yeah, man, I need it. I'm going to try my darndest the past few days. It's just getting tricky to actually find the time. But I must say, I've been pleasantly surprised at the amount of birds that I'm seeing revisiting fields in my travels. You know, and some of them are areas that are close to ground that I could be hunting. So I'm trying to figure out how to hunt some of those birds and also make it work with my work schedule. And that's getting real tricky. But I think I got two or three days lined up at my my typical hunting location that I'm gonna give it give the old college try, I guess, and see what happens.
That's all you can do. Just keep after them.
For sure. Dayton, thanks for chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me on here.